everybody. Welcome to Tech Can't Save Us podcast by Literal Humans. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Paul David, CEO and co-founder of Literal Humans. I am joined today by my co-founder. I'll let Will introduce himself here.
Yep. The co-founder of Literal Humans and the chief strategy officer, whatever that means, joining for another wonderful episode of Tech Can't Save Us.
Means a little bit of everything. And we're joined today by a very welcome guest, Adam Gans, professor of screenwriting at Royal Holloway University of London. He's also the head of the writer's room at Story Futures Academy. And Story Futures Academy itself is a partnership between the National Film and Television School in Royal Holloway. Very much welcome to the pod, Adam.
It's great to be here. I'm really looking forward to chatting to you guys about what we do and what you do. It's really exciting to have the chance to be here and to talk a little bit more about storytelling and immersive, which is what we concentrate on.
Sounds good. Well, first things first, on Tech Can't Save Us, we like to talk about the headlines that are relevant to our guests' area of expertise. So one that I shared from our partners over at Sifted was a piece about a VR startup that's actually London-based called MoonHub. They just raised $2.6 million to hitch workplace training up to VR-powered training gear. So the idea is that it's more cost-effective and it's less time-consuming than traditional methods. Very curious, Adam, if this sounds like right up your alley. I know there's a workplace training element to the work you're doing with VR and AR. So we'd love to, get your reaction to this headline. What do you see in the funding landscape for what you're doing? Have you heard of MoonHub before? Are you excited about it? What's your take?
I hadn't heard of MoonHub before, but it was great to see what they're doing. And I think that VR has real opportunities for training people, both the opportunity to do hands-on experience. I mean, partly also the opportunity to do things together. I mean, an operating theatre is called a theatre because actually everybody could sit and watch operations. And it was the way that surgeons learned. If you go, you can actually go visit the old operating theatre by St. Thomas's Hospital. And actually the opportunity, particularly in things like hands-on training, to do things together, to watch other people doing things together, and to be able to kind of make mistakes, which I guess you don't really want happening in surgery, but in VR, you can really getting the hands-on opportunity. I've seen wonderful, quite simple things just in how to do quite complicated physical things. You can really see the difference and you can participate and watch those things. I think it's really wonderful. And I think that the opportunity for doing that, talking to other people, learning in small groups and getting back together, all of those opportunities are great. And I think it's really a question of designing the content well, thinking about what works well in bursts, how long can people be in that environment. But I think it can work really well. You're in VR for a while, you go and do something together, you go and do something offline in a different way, you come back in VR. I think it can be an incredibly exciting way of working around the world, and particularly when there's an opportunity to kind of prototype really complex processes, visual processes, witnessing things together. I think the opportunities are astonishing, really.
Something I'd kind of be interested to get both of your thoughts on is, do you feel like this is sort of just the beginning and, it's the start of sort of a 10-year process that ends with, this interview that we're doing now, over Zoom? Does it become something where everyone just chucks on their quick headset and it's, you feel like you're in the room? Is it almost we're starting with the super practical applications, like you said? Yeah, real specialist hands-on training. But then that technology filters down and suddenly you just get to a point where, people don't do a video conference anymore. They do a VR conference and, it's almost that become that day-to-day part of your life, the way in the last 2 years because of the pandemic, Zoom meetings have, whereas before they were far more kind of a business conferencing thing.
I mean, to some extent, I think it's less of the VR problem than the rest of life problem. I mean, what's great about a Zoom meeting is actually we're able to integrate all of the things that we do really easily. And I've got, as well as I can see you, I've got my notes just in front of me for some of the points that we might be discussing. I've got my phone here so I can check something else. And it seems to me that it's how do we integrate VR into our spatial infrastructure and have all the tools that are ready? Because if I've got VR on, it's actually really hard to do things like use a pencil and paper. I think it's more perhaps solving the hardware problem or the conceptual problem of being able to be in several different spaces at once. And there's one really great thing about VR, which it means that you are absolutely focused on what you're doing. And it's very hard to focus, to be aware of anything else. Now, for certain forms of training, that's great. For being in a meeting, that's actually quite problematic, partly because you sometimes want to take different forms of notes. You want to look something up to contribute to the conversation. You know, and maybe you also want to deal with the fact that somebody might come in the room and tell you that something else important is happening whilst in a Zoom call, I just go on mute for a bit. So I think to some extent, the real issue is how do we integrate it best into our lives? The absolute kind of sensory deprivation or total focus of VR, we can do really well. But I think it's the how it merges into the rest of our existence is the thing that needs attention. And that's actually one reason why I think that the link that you mentioned about Apple moving into the space is really, really interesting, just because it's something that they're incredibly good at. Is how do people integrate technologies into their lives, partly just being able to plug and play is usually very good, but also people do really think about usability and the kind of total integration of each piece of new technology into kind of the ways that people are living, and being also ready to think about how we adapt to the technology and how the technology adapts to us.
I was going to say, just on the topic of integration, I think two other examples from that sifted piece were, you know, this Finnish startup Varjo, which raised an astonishing $54 million in its first 18 months of launching. They're using in situations like training for pilots and astronauts. And then to bring it back to the UK, UK's digital surgery, they have this touch surgery technology now that allows surgeons to practice virtually before an operation. And they just got sold to, technology giant Medtronic in 2020 for over $500 million. So, I mean, we're seeing this integration move into really interesting areas. And really pushing the practice, I would say, of different disciplines in ways that we hadn't seen before.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really exciting. And I think one of the, in surgery training or engineering training or flying training or astronaut training, you know, when there is that amount of funding going into it and and the potential savings are so good in all sorts of ways, you have really exciting possibilities, like when you look at what happens with Formula One training and actually how flight simulators become really good games as well as really good kind of training mechanisms, because actually exploring the possibilities of those technologies are really exciting. And I think we've rarely seen entertainment made at that level of investment. I think about obviously things like Vader Immortal or whatever, but it's hard to think about stuff that has been able to really make something as substantial as, say, the digital surgery training. But I also think it would be a whole lot of fun, probably, for even people like us to get into the digital touch surgery. And I imagine we would find that both we'd learn a lot, but I think we'd also find it a really interesting space to be in, you know, even though I'm not going to be a surgeon, I've now realized, you know, but I think it would be very interesting to explore what that might teach us about our own bodies. You know, it's interesting to think about what those new interfaces might be, you know, things that you wouldn't necessarily have thought about being entertaining, even like a driving simulator or simulating town planning or whatever, actually becomes incredibly exciting game or entertainment. And I imagine that a lot of the places where VR is being, you know, simulations are being made to this quality will actually be really opportunities for entertainment.
I feel like you see that kind of almost already on social media, just where it's like, hey, come spend the accounts that have millions of followers, because they just show you like, hey, here's what a blacksmith does. And it's just little 15-second clips of, you know, like, hey, but this is how you make sure horseshoe or whatever. And to be able to do that in VR is like, you're going to be take that concept and turn it up to by 100. I think what comes across there from the Sifted piece and some of the other sort of stuff we did in the research, this is, you know, there really is a real appetite for investment with regards to some of those more specialist use cases. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I can totally get how this would train astronauts. I can totally get how this would train, you know, like you said, car mechanics, welders, those proper hands-on practical applications. Just kind of circling it back to more of that kind of mass market, what do you guys think is kind of the key to making it far more of something that, you know, we're not using it to learn how to become a surgeon, but, you know, we're using it in the day-to-day lives as just normal people. Relatively affordable VR has been around for, you know, a good 5 years now. Some of the VR headsets you can buy, it's definitely building a sort of small but committed platform, but it hasn't, you know, exploded the way of like an iPhone or an iPod did when they first hit the market. What do you think is holding it back? Is it kind of, like you said, Adam, that kind of, yeah, it's a very specific use case where you might watch a film or listen to a music on it, but it's too all encompassing and it doesn't allow you to do other stuff while you're doing it, which very much limits its applicable uses. It's not really integrated with the day-to-day tech of our lives. Or is it just a case of no one's put enough investment and funding into creating cool virtual VR experiences yet? And so once they do that, there will be a mass market for it.
I don't know. I think, for me anyway, there is a kind of limit just of like how long can I go for total immersion? And equally, you know, who will support me in doing that? You know, we're very fortunate at Story Fusions to have a kind of tech team who can guide us and support us. But at home, I find it quite difficult to kind of load stuff up and prepare it and focus it and whatever, you know? And even then, I'm not always sure that I want to spend that amount of time, you know, isolated in that way. So I think I'm very interested in the mixed reality, augmented reality stuff. We're working on a project called Story Trails, which will be available in 15 towns around the country. And we'll also on using AR and LiDAR scanning, but AR to tell, it's a partnership with Nexus and the BFI and the Reading Agency, and the lead creative is David Olashoga, and we're putting the BFI and BBC archive on the street to be discovered using augmented reality. And I think that's really exciting to have stories in place, but also to consume different kinds of stories in different ways. That feels to me incredibly exciting. And I also think that the opportunities of thinking about what long form might be like, I also think that, you know, what level of intensity people can take, you know, I mean, one of the things of VR is amazing when it's really intense, but maybe we need not to be all of that intense some of the time, you know, so that we really appreciate it when it comes. I'm also quite interested in some of the, like, in reading Sid Meier's autobiography about, you know, the guy who did Civilization, but talking about, like, the pleasure of actually discovering the rules as being one of the kind of really interesting ways, you know, there's playing to a script, but there's also kind of exploring the possibilities of what those rules might be and world building possibilities. And that seems to me something else that is going to be one of the things that I think VR, AR, mixed reality has real opportunities. So I think it's an incredibly exciting space. And I think, you know, if we were able to kind of pool together everything that everybody is learning, I think there are incredible opportunities, obviously, for technical, you know, IP reasons, people are quite reluctant to share. But quite soon, I think, you know, there will be a group of people who are playing and consuming and learning and getting the opposite to try things out. And I think that generation is actually going to come up with some really, really exciting kinds of narrative.
Yeah, just to respond there, thank you for mentioning Sid Meier's Civ 6. I've wasted many an hour. I'm very much a Civilization 6 fanboy, especially during the pandemic. Spent a lot of time, yeah, just building worlds and enjoying that game. And so, yeah, I'd be curious to follow up and watch, you know, that documentary. So, and I'll be emailing you about that shortly, Adam. want to move us into some of the questions that we had, because you mentioned a couple of things that Story Futures is doing. So I want to really dig in and get a good understanding of the work that you're doing. So first question, just start us out, you know, give our audience the basics. What is immersive storytelling? And just, you know, in a minute or two, what's like a simple explanation that folks can carry with them when they leave the podcast here?
Oh, immersive storytelling, I guess, is one, it's something that happens within a medium. So, but it's also something where the audience kind of works with the story to piece it together, collaboratively thinking about the story spatially, narratively, to use technology to tell themselves a story, thinking about how it exists around it, in which, you know, the participant or participants are also part of the story in one way or another. More specifically, it tends to mean virtual reality, augmented reality, mixed reality, kind of experiences where people are coming together to be both present together, but also present perhaps remotely with other people. So I guess things like escape rooms, things like kind of technological puzzle solving, things like various experiences where people are kind of spatially working with others to kind of discover the story. I would say things like the kind of the avatars and, you know, ABBA Voyage, those kind of things are probably also forms of immersive storytelling. I think where technology, humans, and narrative combine.
Maybe just more from the you know, the sort of history side of things. How did kind of Story Futures come about? Like, you know, what was the creation? What's its origin story, so to speak?
Well, it began with, you know, the government in a way, like the Arts and Humanities Research Council, which is like funding. It's always been in the UK that, you know, universities have worked with industry to find a new drug or think about how a plane flies better or whatever, that relationship has been taken for granted on science or technology or pharmacology. The question was, how might that work on the humanities side? You know, so they've funded 8 creative clusters, of which we are one, like Story Futures is one, to think about the digital and digital relationships and how universities and academics might help that process. So there's one looking at fashion or looking at film industries in Northern Ireland. We're specializing in immersive storytelling. So, but thinking about how might stories, how might academics contribute to help small and medium-sized companies tell stories better, and how can universities help them? So we have a like help with audience research. We might help with formatting the stories or devising what, you know, drawing on, you know, me as a screenwriter or colleagues who work in theatre or music or whatever, and then also thinking about how best to build their business and working with colleagues in business and management to kind of think about value chains or think about diversity in the industry, or how can academics help companies tell better stories? That's actually been really exciting and really generally really successful. We've done a lot of very interesting projects and partnerships with Heathrow Airport or the National Gallery or whatever. And the Story Futures Academy was to think specifically about training people to work in the immersive sectors. That's been bringing on people, not entry level, but actually finding ways to encourage people to move into the sector. So we've had placements, we've done all sorts of training workshops or opportunities. And I think that's been really exciting to kind of, we've learned from them. I hope they've learned from us. And I, you know, we've helped to create new jobs, advance new skills, and I think really strengthen the sector in the UK and also with partnerships with Canada or US or other places.
Just say that it definitely is working. The way that we found out about Story Futures Academy is my girlfriend's a film director, and she actually took one of the courses and immediately recommended that we get in touch with you guys for a podcast, because she just thought, you know, these couldn't be a cooler example of like, you know, just tech being used for fascinating and purposes and good purposes, which is what we're all about on Tech Can't Save Us.
That's really great to hear. Yeah. I mean, just to say that we're, you know, one of the things is just this technology is often really expensive and it's really hard for people to go and find out what it can do, play around with it. You know, we've started doing some stuff around virtual production where incredibly exciting medium, but normally nobody dare play with it because, you know, it costs so much. Or equally, the opportunity for creative people like your girlfriend or other people just to come into the space and think about it in a slightly different way if people don't have the time to do that. So I think we've had an open door policy. We've tried to encourage as many people from as diverse a range of backgrounds as possible to come and see what's going on, but also see that what ideas might they have, the thing which maybe incrementally or suddenly help the sector tell better stories, equally have people who think about this as another place that they're going to want to work.
Professor Gand, you mentioned a few examples there. We'd love to dig in specifically to, like, you know, maybe one micro case study, what, you know, maybe a win that you're most excited about that you achieved at Story Futures, or just, you know, a good example of a, you know, an excellent, you know, workforce training program that you all co-developed. We'd love to hear that.
One really great project was a company called Maze Theory. They're doing the Peaky Blinders VR project. And they wanted to find writers who could help them, you know, who understand writing for television, but also would be good at writing in this new medium. And we did a fantastic two-day workshop. We worked with Punch Drunk in Richmond, who are kind of one of the pioneers in spatial storytelling in the theatre. And they came with their tech team, with their creative team, and we just explored storytelling and the possibilities of the medium. At the end of the day, one of the people would go on and do a placement with them, but that person is now works full time for them. I think it was incredibly exciting for everyone to think about what the medium might do, what it might be like. We found that the writers offered them ways of solving some of their technical problems. I mean, historically, you know, writers have always been really good at fixing issues, from like writing a scene in front of the curtains whilst they changed them behind the curtains in the theatre, you know, in the 17th century or whatever. Actually, you've got a rendering problem. You could try and render it, or maybe the writer can set the scene where something else happens whilst you're doing something else backstage. If everybody starts to understand those problems, then they can solve them together. So I think basically it was really, really great for all the writers who participated. It was great training for the companies. It created employment opportunities. And I'm really excited to see a little bit of the taste of the stuff that they've coming out with. But I, you know, I think it's going to be a very, very exciting title when it comes to market, you know?
Amazing. Peaky Blinders VR, very much something to get excited about. Kind of just wrapping up, you know, these sort of top level questions about Story Futures. You know, in your mind, where do you think Story Futures and maybe just immersive storytelling generally kind of sits within the larger, what we call tech for good ecosystem? You know, tech trying to solve problems in the world and, you know, just ultimately make the world a better place.
I think, you know, one reason why people tell stories is because they're incredibly inspired about what they want to share with the world and the way that they want people to think about that. And we come across lots of really great stories. Stories both need technologists, they need people who can be sympathetic with those ideas, people working together, sharing how best to tell stories, but also to tell stories about things that really matter. And, you know, audiences like stories that really matter. When Star Wars, let's say, which I mentioned, that was a weird passion project that just happened to kind of connect to the world in an extraordinary way. And it also came from somebody, George Lucas at that point, who was incredibly knowledgeable about cinema and storytelling and watched obscure Japanese films or whatever, you know, and thought about how do I bring these things together? And I hope similarly that people being informed about what's going on, but also encouraged to draw on a range of storytelling references And so we learn from others and with others, whether they're filmmakers or storytellers or technologists or VR experts. It's through that kind of sharing with one another and with the audience that great stories will be made. And I hope that we can do a little bit to help people tell those stories together.
Fantastic. Well, it sounds like you're doing incredible work, from Peaky Blinders to workplace training, you know, across different UK industries. The work that Story Future is doing is really pioneering and innovating. So thank you for sharing that with us. I'm going to move us ahead into the lightning round. Professor Gans, we would like to ask about more personal questions to get to know our guests, and it's all connected to tech and tech for good. So first one we like to start out with, and I'm particularly interested in your answer, this one is, what kind of tech stack do you work with in your job? You're playing with AR, VR, mixed reality. And if you can mention maybe a game-changing tech product that you use, we'd love to share with our audience.
The thing, I mean, I thought about this. We've started doing a lot of stuff with LiDAR scanning, and we're using the new Apple iPhone 12 and 13 LiDAR stuff. I think LiDAR is incredibly exciting, and I think something extraordinary is going to happen with that many people using it in that many different ways. The real game changer, perhaps for me and for us, was there were these little binaural Roland headphones. You know, I think binaural sound is extraordinary, and it's so cheap, and it's so, you know, it is the most immersive sense that we have. You know, we see kind of pretty much still in one direction, but we hear in every direction. And I think sound is incredibly important for VR and for understanding that. It's so easy to prototype things with Roland headphones and a little Zoom recording. In fact, we did a wonderful workshop in lockdown where we posted this tech out to people, and we had some really exciting work made by people in lockdown, talking about lockdown, working in their homes, but actually with something that created some really extraordinary work. So I'm really, really excited about binaural sound. We've done something recently with the Imperial War Museum with a called One Story, Many Voices that your listeners can pick up on, which is binaural sound stories about the Second World War and the Holocaust around the country, which were made in connection with the opening of the Second World War and the Holocaust galleries at the Imperial War Museum. The opportunity to be spatially in a different place, sound offers so cheaply. And so it's an emotionally game-changing thing, I think. It's the opportunity to create a kind of point cloud portrait of a space, to see people not just as an image, but also to record the way in which they inhabit space. And then so we get a kind of portrait of the shell and the space that we inhabit. We've also worked with a company called ScanLab Projects, who do really wonderful work. But I think the ability to make a little model of oneself for other people and to share that, including the kind of flaws and the failures, is, I think, something that is going to be, in the same way that we have a photo of our family, I think we're going to have a little model of our family. We're going to have a model of the people that we know. We're going to be sharing models of ourselves and other people. And I think something is going to happen where, you know, understanding people as photographs kind of changed the way that the world thought about other human beings from the 19th century on. I think thinking about people as little as existing in space and being shareable is going to change the way that the 21st century thinks about other human beings. I hope that it evokes a kind of compassion and a kind of humanity about other people, which I think is incredibly moving, incredibly affecting, and it makes us think about both their presence and their absence at the same time in a way that I think is hugely exciting to think about what it offers in a creative possibilities of being able to exchange that.
Yeah, totally. I'm certainly excited by it ourselves as well. Just moving on to this next question, the lightning round. What do you think is one problem that tech can't solve for us and why?
People. You know, you mentioned, you know, one of the possible issues was like about harassment and hate speech in the metaverse. I mean, humans will remain humans whatever technology happens, and technology can magnify humans for better or for worse. You know, we always need to think about both what is the counter to that technology? How can one kind of encourage it to work for good? But, you know, I think we also need to make sure that there are always humans, even if we're talking about AI, let's say we're actually talking about models that humans make of other humans and why often AI is deeply sexist or makes all kinds of assumptions about ethnicities or behaviors or whatever. It's actually because the people who are devising those AI reproduce their own ways of looking at the world. You know, so I think we really need to think about how do we maximize the best of humanity and how do we also kind of make sure that we deal with the fact that humans sometimes, you know, represent the very worst things and technology can magnify those possibilities. And we always need to bear that in mind.
Just to throw a potential spanner in the works here, just a fun one. I was reading an article the other day about, I guess it was a report about Google putting a engineer on leave because he was sort of starting to claim that one of their AIs had become sentient. So is anyone else scared of that? Like Skynet, Terminator stuff? Like, is that something we need to worry about? Is that just a completely, you know, complete fantasy? I'm always curious about that question. Just a fun one.
Well, sometimes I think it may well be already there in that, you know, who knows what the AIs are reading, what the bots are when I'm trying to talk to my bank or whatever it might be. Do you know what I mean? We don't know to some extent or what all the boss wear and whatever is doing. Do you know what I mean? Maybe, who knows why my internet suddenly gets bad or whatever. Do you know? You know, we don't know. But I think we have to bear in mind what those possibilities are and that we imagine things because there are possibilities for that technology. So, but I think we have to be constantly vigilant about who might do what with this technology. I was thinking as I was reading your great list of questions about Isaac Asimov's rules for robots, you know, and thinking we broke everyone pretty quickly, didn't we? You know, like no robot can do any harm to a human. Well, it's got that one. Do you know what I mean? So I'm just wondering what those rules might be and maybe also, I was thinking back with that first wave of like Rockefeller and Carnegie and, do you know what I mean? That first wave, like people who had access to railways and these extraordinary powers. Somebody said at a certain point, this is too much power. We need to stop it. And actually what the state where Facebook or all of these other things are is actually that to the power of however much. So I do think we also need to make sure that we have democratic control of these systems. Otherwise, it will be either the AI or AI made in the image of some of the people controlling those technologies that will be determining what the world looks like and what those moral choices are.
Very first for Tech Can't Save Us. I think we might have just had a suggestion that when your Wi-Fi slows down, it could be AI gaming the system. I think that might be the first time we've had that. So I know Paul had something to follow up with there that wasn't silly. So I'll leave.
It's a little bit silly, but just the irony of you know, the world potentially be ending by a company that started out with this motto as "Don't be evil" is just it's not lost on me. I just love that, and also I just read that the engineer in question is currently on his honeymoon and is not available until the 21st of June. So that gives the AI a solid week to kind of, you know, launch its plan and do what it needs to do. So I just find the whole story hilarious.
Who's he on honeymoon with, and are they, you know, are they real or not? Yeah, it is. Don't be evil. Well, okay, be a little bit evil. Maybe you can be a tiny, you know.
Don't be totally evil. To be fair, something I do think, and it's a conversation we've had a lot on other pods, and I do think, and in, you touched upon it several times, Adam, I do think there is a lot of, in this space and just generally, sort of gung-ho attitude to let's just build it and see what happens, and no then responsibility for like, oh yeah, we probably shouldn't have made it in any way an option for people in the metaverse to be able to like sexually assault other people, or, you know, like it, we have the tech to solve those problems, but we choose not to do it. And I do think there needs to be more onus on some of the, you know, not just the social media platforms, but the people developing tech, which is like, yeah, like you said, build this in a way that maximizes the good while being very aware of the fact that people can be totally awful sometimes, and that if that happens, using your technology, you are in some ways responsible for it. And you do need to, you know, you can't just wash your hands of it. Like I think a lot of social platforms do, where they go, oh, well, it's not our problem if people are using our platform to spread hate speech. And it's like, well, whose problem is it then? Like who, where else in society would we accept that, where you just go, oh, well, you know, 1 out of 100 of our chairs blows up and kills people, but whatever. But I know this feeds in perfectly well to Paul's favorite question of our lightning round, which I'll now let him ask.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we're a tech for good podcast, but we like to talk about tech for bad. So just curious about, Professor Gans, what you believe is the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there. And I'm particularly interested to see if it lands in the MR, VR, AR space as well.
Well, I don't know. I was going to talk about kind of bossware and stuff like that. But actually, I was really thinking about picking up on what you were just saying, William, this thing about, is it really true that Tesla switched off the autopilot like 1 second before the crash so that they could claim that it was a human in charge for every crash? Do you know what I mean? That seems to me like both, like basically you've got lawyers. Do you know what I mean? You've got, it's actually this technology which is meant to be about driving is actually about, you know, you've actually got a lawyer in charge that says like, oh, no, it wasn't me, governor. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't, you know, actually you've got someone thinking about how do I not take responsibility? How shortly before can we then say, no, we're in every 98% of our crashes, we know that it was a human in charge because we actually disconnected the autopilot like 1 second before. It makes sense. In a world which is actually driven by lawyers, press statements to actually be able to say that. But that does feel like how can we really not take responsibility both for what we've built, but actually for anything that happens, because our entire processes and systems are devised to make sure that we have no legal responsibility for what happens with the thing that we've built. I guess that's one way to become an extremely wealthy person, but actually it's equally, what a way to kind of go through the world kind of saying, you know, when I was in the playground, people say, I had my fingers crossed, you can't, you know, to actually go through the entire world building something that could be so extraordinary, but the key thing that you build up in is like making sure not that it's kind of doesn't have accidents, but that when it does have accidents, you can possibly claim not to be legally responsible for them. Now, that's evil genius, I would say.
If your answer to that question is lawyers, then I think that's, no one's going to ever beat that answer. That's an excellent that's an excellent answer. The winner chicken dinner used to be Facebook. I think now it's lawyers. So we'll see if future guests can beat that. Well done.
That's brilliant. Maybe moving more onto the aspirational side of things, away from the quagmire of lawyers. If you could dream up one new tech product, you know, what would it be, and what would the problem that it solves be, and for whom?
Well, I was thinking about, the one it would solve for me would be like an AI that finished things off. Do you know what I mean? I could teach it like the job that is quite interesting for the first 40 minutes and then gets really dull. Do you know what I mean? That actually, I could show it the way and it would then finish stuff off. And I can think about all sorts of kind of, you know, from doing my accounts to whatever, I could just kind of start it off and teach it and it would then finish. That would be my kind of dream AI. Do you know what I mean? I could kind of work out the setting. So, you know, for some things you would do like 40 minutes and some you could just teach it like in 15 minutes and it would kind of perform the task that you had showed it how to do.
I'll tell you what, as a writer, I definitely am intrigued by these you know, early stage AI writing products. And it's something that, you know, we chatted about with our writing team a bit. And, you know, again, I don't want to take, right, I'm now on record as someone who maybe wants to take writer's jobs. I don't want to do that. But, you know, the idea of like finishing a product, finishing an outline that you produce, enriching an outline or synopsis that you produce, or even starting off and maybe doing the first, you know, 40% and then a writer can dig in and deepen it. I've already seen publications like Bloomberg produce a good chunk of their writing, I think up to 40-50% using AI. A lot of sports publications, you know, because it's just sort of numbers and who scored this and who did that, are already using AI writing tools. So I find that to be a really fascinating space of, you know, could you start things or get halfway there or complete things as well? So very much agree with that.
Yeah, very interested also to see what happens when you start, as you see where people try and game those tools or see what else happens. I have a friend who is a film editor, and he said to me, the audience has to be right about 80% of the time. Like, you guess what's going to happen. Do you know what I mean? But you have to be wrong like at least 20% of the time. Otherwise, it's dull. But I think like you need that combination of human and AI is really important. Like, when things are ready to go in a surprising direction, maybe it's the AI that throws in the curveball, or maybe it's going to be the human who challenges AI, or the AI challenges the human. But I think people need to be surprised. Humans, like AI, are quite good at learning things. So I think once we get familiar with something, you know, once, you know, certain forms, whether it's forms of music or forms of story, seem incredibly exciting. And then we've learned how it's done. A number of people have been like watching The Sopranos or The Wire after 20 years, do you know what I mean? And start partly thinking, wow, that was groundbreaking. But now some of it doesn't seem that groundbreaking. It feels quite stale because so many people have copied those approaches, you know, that we think of them as memes. And maybe how we learn to work with those tools, you know, how we continue to get that balance of the familiar and the surprising, which is, I think, what we always are looking for.
Well, we like to always close out on a positive note. And since this is a Tech for Good podcast here, Tech Can Save Us, we like to, you know, just end on a personal note and hear a little bit about your career. A big part of Tech for Good is, you know, folks balancing profit and earning money and taking care of themselves and their families, but also, you know, balancing that with purpose and doing something good for the world. You're working in the space of workforce development with Story Futures, and that's great. So we'll just be curious how you've navigated that in your career, obviously sort of providing for you know, yourself and family, but making the world a better place through Tech for Good Ventures. Love to hear your take on that.
I mean, I've been lucky. I've gone in and out of like education, writing, sometimes more successfully than others, and teaching. And occasionally that is so mind-blowing. Like, there were a couple of people, I mean, this is from teaching at Royal Holloway, but two people came back to talk to students. One was Josh Wardle, who made Wordle, who did his like undergraduate degree at Royal Holloway. And the other was a guy called Matt Dryhurst, who's been working with Holly Herndon on Holly Plus, you know, and both of them said something which was the kind of the same thing. They said, we were really encouraged to find out new things, to push the envelope, look at art or digital art or odd things or surprising things, to make things for ourselves, to understand the kind of history and the theory of the medium that we were working in. And actually, that became incredibly valuable because that didn't age. Like, being encouraged to think and make connections didn't age. Like, learning how to use a particular software or even how to make something in a particular context does age, you know? But actually thinking about conceptual work didn't age. And Josh was saying, like, being in Silicon Valley and being interested in art gave him, and having seen all these kind of, been to all these galleries or thought about kind of storytelling and creativity, actually gave him a huge lead that he didn't know he had of being in, you know, being able to tell stories, being interested in humans in a different way. And also to take incredibly counterintuitive decisions. You know, with Wordle, he said, like, the aim is you want to hold people on your site for as long as possible. No, you're only going to do one thing for one day. But also he made it for his partner, but he was saying, this is really like giving people a gift. And like, people are remote, like being able to say, Paul, how did you do on Wordle today? Being able to share that with people was actually like, he said, it was like being able to kind of say you loved people remotely, like to check in with your family, or, you know, he lives in the States, his family's in the UK. It was a way of giving people a little, like, not, hey, I love you, man, but just being able to kind of pass on a moment of connection, shared connection each day. And, the, you know, there was a huge need for that. Actually, it was interesting to see how it was very much thinking about stories, thinking about art, thinking about communication, thinking about ideas that had given him the possibility to do that. And it was wonderful to feel that me and the colleague, particularly other colleagues who he'd worked with, had given him that opportunity. And it was something that he still clearly valued.
Incredibly small world. So the chap who invented Wordle, his brother is the executive producer on the film My Girlfriend's Working On. So small world.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thank you so much. I think we've kind of got to the end of all of our lightning round questions. So pretty much what she wrote. So I just wanted to say a massive thank you for coming on the pod, Adam. It was an absolute pleasure and so fascinating to learn about immersive storytelling and all the different sort of strands of, you know, what story futures are up to and just, you know, the future of what we see for VR and AR. I had a great time. I loved it. Hopefully our audience did as well.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really great to participate. There are still a few options on our website. I should also have said that all our training is free and there are a couple of opportunities. So do check out what we're doing. And we've done various kind of free downloadable reports onto skills in VR, skills in virtual production. We'd love to see or hear from any listeners, but it's been really great to talk to you both. And Shakira, great to meet you too. So thanks so much for having me. It's been a blast.
This has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Professor Gans. And real quick, we want to give our audience a quick call to action. So where can they go to find more out about Story Futures and Story Trails? What are the sites there?
Storyfutures.com. And there's a storyfutures.com/academy, I think. story-trails.co.uk, I think. Equally, if you're in 15 towns from Omagh through Dundee and Dumfries in Scotland to Blackpool, Lincoln, Wolverhampton, Sheffield, Bradford, can I remember them all? Newport, Swansea, Swindon, Slough,
Lewisham,
and Lambeth, like, do come and see what we're doing, participate in what we're doing. We're working in the local libraries and on the streets of all of those cities. There'll be wonderful opportunities to find out what technology can do and find out what at least some of the future of this technology is going to be.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you so much. This has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast. As always, I'm Paul David, co-founder and CEO of Literal Humans. I'm joined by my colleague, William Gadsby Pete, Chief Strategy Officer and co-founder as well. And we've been joined today by Adam Gans, Professor of Screenwriting at Royal Holloway, University of London, and the head of the Writers' Room at Story Futures Academy. Thank you so much, guys, for tuning in.